afternoon. Good afternoon.
Looking to see what we're up to at this point.
Right. Okay. So we've now been out of this for a few weeks, right? Because we discussed Purim 2 weeks ago, and then last week was Purim. So it's been a while. Not that you can ever forget what happened to start this story, but the nation's reaction when he sends out the parts around the around the nation, they all respond with horror at what happens, and they gather either from all parts of the land or they gather in corners as separate tribes. We talked about that, or the leaders of the tribes all gathered, and they ask him, so tell us the story, meaning they already heard some of the story or they wouldn't have come in the first place, but they want to hear it from him. And this quasi-husband tells them what happened. We talked about how he colored the story a little bit, took out some of the parts that made him look not so good, and the nation decides we are going to set things straight and we are going to punish the people of Gibeah. What they do not do, and that's what we're going to come back to today, is they don't say we're going to ask Binyamin to carry out justice. They say we are going to kill the people of Gibeah who are responsible for what has happened. So, yeah.
Isn't there some history also with Binyamin that it sort of adds to the bad?
So there really isn't. We don't have any backstory with Binyamin being like this. The question is further along in history. We talked about whether this is foreshadowing events with Shaul and David, and we concluded that even that is hard to sustain, because no one really gives Binyamin a hard time after this story. No one in Shaul's day says to him, you know, you're from Gibeah, and Gibeah is where this terrible thing happened. And you have to keep in mind that following the chronology that most have on this story, there are centuries between this story and Shaul. This story is really from the beginning of the time of the Shoftim. And you have a few hundred years after this. So,
and was this written in relation to Shaul?
Well, not when it's written, but when it happens. It happens in the period, the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, and then after that, you have the rise of Shmuel as the last of the Shoftim, and then he's the one who coronates Shaul. But the period of the Shoftim lasts some 400 years, give or take.
So are we certain that
it's the end of the book, but it's the beginning of the book in terms of when it happens. We talked about this, you remember.
So is there any evidence, perhaps, that this is...
Yeah. Okay. There was a side joke. Don't worry about it.
Is there any evidence that this might have been manufactured later? I know we talked about it, but I wasn't sure how we...
Right, and the evidence is not really there. I mean, the arguments are there. There are always people willing to suggest anything about any story in Tanakh. But the story holds together very well, and it holds together as an early story. The evidence is fairly clear that it's an early story. We talked about things like the fact that that the city of Yavuz is still in non-Jewish hands. We talked about the role that Pinchas plays in the story. It really holds together as an early story. There is some of the text which seems odd in the sense that there are apparent repetitions, but you can read it very clearly in a way that explains the repetitions without any real problem, as Yechezkel Kaufman does. I'm very much in the camp that says this story took place in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, and it was shifted to the end, whether in order to demonstrate what happens when we become, when we don't have a king, as a setup for Shmuel, where we will be introduced to monarchy, or whether we say it's because this story, as well as the previous one, the Pesel Micha, talk about Jews versus Jews, whereas the rest of the book was Jews versus the nations around them. We gave various explanations for why it would be shifted. It's not fair for me to assume that people remember what we did a few weeks ago. I have to do a proper recap. But the upshot is, they make the decision, we are going to go to war with Gibeah. And they approach Binyamin. Binyamin did not join in. They were invited to the national gathering. They did not join in. They didn't show up. And thank you. And so the rest of the Shvatim, the rest of the tribes, say to them, turn these guys over to us, and we are going to kill them. And that was the last bit that we had done. It was chapter 20, sentence 13. We had asked the question of why exactly there is a death sentence for all of these people. Is this really correct? The people of Gibeah. And we had said that Abarbanel believes that yes, there is collective responsibility for the people of Gibeah for the terrible sin that took place there and to prevent it from recurring. So he talks about what they wanted to do, what they wanted to do to the man, what they actually did to this woman, the fact that it's a mob of people and not just one person, the idea that Abarbanel has, unlike Ramban, unlike Malbim, that this is actually part of an attempt to prevent there from being passersby. They don't want people coming through and benefiting from their property. So Abarbanel says that's what's going on here. Abarbanel believes that these are genuinely bad people. Malbim, on the other hand, said the sins could be dismissed on technicalities, such as to say, well, she didn't die from their attack, she died from the elements after the attack, perhaps. You could come up with ways to show that a court hearing this case would not find a death penalty. However, this is Haras Shah. This is a ruling of the moment. The nation feels that we have to eliminate this evil from our midst. And there is a concept of extrajudicial execution. The idea that even if a court wouldn't mandate it, where the community feels, or when there's a king, when the king feels that there's something evil that is going on and you have to eliminate it, they have the ability to act on that. This is a ruling of the moment. They say, we need to do this, and that's their basis. And then we had Ramban. And Ramban's view was, in fact, that this war is wrong. We talked about this last time. I brought it as source one on your sheet. I do not have the English there because there was so much else that I wanted to fit on the sheet. And I figured since we read this source last time, it isn't as imperative that the translation be there. Not to mention everyone's Hebrew is really good. So I'm just going to go through it quickly. And I'm coming back to it from last time because last time I didn't have Abarbanel's response to it. And that's what I added in number two. Ramban's view is that the war is, in fact, wrong. He says, "Mipnei shehayu chafetzim va'omrim la'asos nivala k'anshei Sidon." He says, the people in the city wanted to do something terrible like the people of Sodom did. Ra'u ha'shvatim la'asos siyag la'torah. So the tribe said, we are going to protect the Torah, protect the law. Shelo ye'aseh v'lo ye'amer kein b'Yisrael. That nothing like this should ever be done in Israel. K'mo shamru, as the text says, they said, unva'arav ra'am Yisrael. We are going to eliminate evil from the midst of Israel. And he quotes you the Gemara that in fact empowers a Beit Din to do this. That courts have the ability to issue penalties that are not consistent with the Torah's text. Not to violate the Torah, but to protect it. That was their logic, which Ramban quotes. But then he says, in my opinion, this is why the tribes actually lost the war against Binyamin at first, and that's what we're going to get to today. They actually are defeated by Binyamin multiple times before they finally win. Because the war was illegal. Because Binyamin should have been the ones to carry this out. It's really a mitzvah for the tribe to handle this. That's the argument that Ramban brings to say that the war, in fact, was wrong. So we have a spectrum of views, right? Our first view was that this was actually a legal punishment. Our second view is it's not a legal punishment, but it's still right. And then our third view is that they're actually wrong for doing this. Abarbanel disagrees with Ramban, and I just gave you a summary in source number two of his four reasons. First of all, because, as we said, he believes that there's actually a death penalty warranted. He thinks that the people of Gibeah deserve to die. That's number one. Number two, he says, we're going to see the other tribes lose to Binyamin twice before they finally win. If God were simply showing them, you know, what you're doing was actually not right, you should have left it to Binyamin, then either they should have lost once, or they should have continued to lose. Not that they lose twice and then they win the third time.
Third time
the charm, right.
How did one shave it, beat the whole, the rest of
right, well, that's one of the things we have to talk about, is how in the world did they do that? Ramban thinks it's not natural. Well, sort of. You'll see. There's more to Ramban than I'm giving him right now.
You think he said Hashem is making them win because they were not justified?
There's more. We'll see when we see Ramban. It's a little more. It's a little more nuanced than that. And then the last point that he makes is, I'm going to take you back to the end of Sefer Yehoshua, right? One of the best stories in Yehoshua that people never learn, because it's after the distribution of the land, and people just assume the rest of the book is really dull, and so they don't learn it. When Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh are heading east of the Yarden, and they build this major, very large, really oversized mizbeach, oversized altar, and the other tribes think that they've done something terrible, and they go out to either fight a war with them or get them to stop what they're doing, and then they find out it wasn't actually intended in a bad way, it was just a monument, it wasn't a breakaway altar, it wasn't a breakaway mishkan. So when they sent their delegation, if you're going to tell me that the tribes are wrong here, then that means when they sent it then, at that time, they were also wrong. Now, I don't find that last argument compelling, because the truth of the matter is that they didn't make war when they went the first time. They were ready to make war if they needed to, but they didn't actually go to war. And they were going to the actual people who were guilty and having this conversation with them, like, who else could they have gone to? It's not like here, where it's a sub-community that's done something wrong and the Shevet says, you should have come to us.
How do you compare the two sins also?
What do you mean?
I mean, the two, you're saying because they built a monument that might have been a breakaway and this was...
Well, they thought it was. They thought flat out it was. They thought this is an attempt to essentially create Avodah Zarah, to create idolatry. Yeah. So... Abaye Ben-El does not like Ramban's explanation, and he stands by his view that they actually are indeed liable for death. Well, Binyamin rallies their troops to Givah. Let's pick up there. Perek Chav Pasuk Yudalev, sentence 14. Vayeasafu b'nei Binyamin min ha'arim ha'givasa. All the people of Binyamin gathered to Givah. Latzeis lamilchama im b'nei Yisrael. They are going to fight the rest of the Jews. So not only do they not punish wrongdoing, but they actually rally to war in defense of the wrongdoers. Vayispakdu b'nei Binyamin b'yomahu, and they were counted on that day. Meheorim esrim v'shisha elef ish sholef charev. 26,000 swordsmen they rally from their various cities. Levad miyoshvei ha-giv'ah hispagdu shva meyos ish bachur, aside from 700 who came in from Giv'ah itself. And then we saw this last time, mikol ha'am hazeh shva meyos ish bachur iter yad yimino. This group included, this general group of the 26,700, included 700 people who were lefties. And they were slingshot experts. They would not miss a hair's breadth target. Unclear whether what we're saying is, even though they were lefties, which you would think was a handicap, nonetheless, they were really good at this. That would be one way to take it. Or alternatively, that they specialized with the slingshot because they weren't trained in the sword because they were lefties.
What does he tell you?
Literally, it means that the left hand doesn't work. The right hand doesn't work, and it's like sealed up, and therefore he has to use the left. So it in general, it's used to refer to a
but
to a left.
Unique to Binyamin, like they have so many left-handed slingshots.
Not necessarily. It's trying to show their prowess. Like, this is a formidable force. Now you realize they're only a formidable force until you realize that there are 400,000 people on the other side. I don't care how many slingshots you have. But keep in mind that the way we approached it, the way the nation approached it was, Yehuda's going to fight first. In other words, they didn't send everybody in. It's unwieldy to send everybody in. So you're sending in one tribe first. That's worth recognizing.
Why Yehuda? Is there a reason?
Yes, so we talked about this a little bit, and we said that there are a few different layers to the selection of Yehuda, right? It was back in, which pasuk was it?
That was a big tribe.
It wasn't about size.
No?
No. The line was... Where was the line? Yehuda Ya'ala.
That's late.
I think it's after.
Oh, it's after?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you know, we haven't seen
it
yet. Okay,
after.
We haven't seen it yet. Okay, stay tuned. So the Binyamin says we are interested in defending Yivah, and the big question that we left off with last time is, what is wrong with these people? Like, why in the world would they defend Yivah? The nation is coming to you, and yeah, but the nation is coming to you and saying, there are people. Why do you even want them in your midst? Why don't you turn around and say, we're going to hang them ourselves? At least say that.
Because it wasn't all of Gibeah, it was only some Bnei Belial.
That's
right. We have heard good things about Gibeah, and like nobody, but it is everyone. Nobody took them in.
Okay, but they didn't commit the bad thing. It's only a certain
right.
element of
it. According to Ramban, they didn't believe that they had to. You know.
Right, you could take Ramban's view. Ramban's view is that, in fact, they're not liable for death. Then Ramban, Malbim, and so on, they're not liable for death. However bad they are, it's a disagreement about how we should deal with the problem. Ricky, you were going to say?
And also, if they go to war, it's not only the people from Gibeah that are going to suffer, it's going to be people from the entire Binyamin.
Why?
Tribe.
Why?
Because
they don't war.
No, the war is just against Gibeah. They're coming to battle a particular city. They're not interested in fighting. They ask Binyamin to join them.
Yeah, but the Anshei Binyamin, the soldiers, they're going to get...
No, why?
The Binyamin, well, in the war, people die.
Right. You're saying if Binyamin were to carry this out themselves, they would get hurt by the people of Gibeah.
No.
Any time you have war...
But why is
Gibeah... Both sides are going to die.
Right.
As opposed to letting it be, if they're going against the entire nation...
The Benjamin people are going to suffer, not just the Gibeah people.
What we're talking about is that...
Sorry, my head doesn't work.
That's all right. What we're saying is that Binyamin has three choices, right? Binyamin has three options. Option number one, take care of business and Gibeah yourselves. Option number two is... Say to everybody else, okay, go ahead. We'll join with you. We'll watch you, whatever it's going to be. And option number three is, let's go to war against all the Jewish people and protect Gibeah. And they chose door number three. That's what's so inexplicable. Number one, because Gibeah is so rotten. And number two, why in the world do you want to fight against everybody else? If you're really worried about damage, this ain't the way to go.
But there are... tribes or people that will fight for their own till their last man.
Yes.
Because they're their own.
Yeah. So that's the view. What Etty suggests is Yechezkel Kaufman's view. Take a look at source number four. Professor Kaufman says, and I just took out the words that I felt summed it up, Haregesh Hashivti Gavar al Hahakara Hamusarit. Tribal instinct overpowered moral judgment. These are ours. You don't mess with ours. And this goes back to a theme that we've discussed off and on throughout the book of Shoftim, which is the fact that they don't really see themselves as a national entity, like in Devorah, right? When Devorah summons everybody for war, and some of the tribes come, and some of the tribes don't come. Gideon had this problem as well when he went to war against Midian, and there were some who participated, and some who said, you know, let's sit this one out, because we don't know if you're going to win. The reality is that they don't necessarily see themselves as responsible to the nation. That's one possible explanation. Abarbanel takes a different tack. Take a look at source number three now. Abarbanel says it's that they don't like the way this was done. V'hine zachar shebnei binyamin chara apam lefi shelo shalchu aleihem bnei Yisrael mitchila v'asu haskama shelo midatam. They're angry that the Jews did not first send to them, but instead they made up their mind. Now, Binyamin had been invited to the general meeting, but they felt this is our tribe. It's our business. Who are you to come in here and tell us what we ought to do? You know, what we'll do with them, we'll figure it out. But you're not invading our territory to do this. And that's another possible explanation. The third possible explanation could simply be that they've gone Canaanite. You know, at this point, they've become like the Canaanim. That's the whole message of the book, is when you don't conquer the Canaanim, you are influenced by them instead. And therefore, they feel like, you know what? This isn't the end of the world, the fact that this happened. Maybe they're really not as horrified as everybody else is. That's hard to sustain, only because why them over anybody else? That's difficult. But I think the fundamental explanation really ought to be that this comes back to the Ein Melech B'Yisrael phenomenon. There is no king. And if there is no king, who gives you the right to judge me? You're no greater than anybody else. You're no more credible than anybody else. So don't impose your view on me. That's their argument. Side note, but an interesting one, just in terms of language. Did you see the word that was used in sentence 15 regarding missing the mark? We're talking about a slingshot. The word in the Hebrew. Yeah, it was sentence 16, sorry. Right? Velo yachdi. Correct. The kolea ba'evan el hasara, right? To sling the rock to the hair, to the hair's breadth target. Velo yachti.
Yachti or
yachta?
Yachti.
Well, that's the question, is what does the word yachti...
Could be also...
The question is, what does the word yachti mean? So, you have English translations, what does it say?
Miss.
So, indeed, this is the idea that the word chait is something which is lacking or something which is missing. There's a comment from Tosfot in source number 5. Tosfot is an anthology of commentaries on the Talmud written by sages generally in Western Europe in the basically 11th to early 14th centuries. It includes some of Rashi's grandsons in the authors of the Tosfot. So here, he's commenting on a completely different verse. It's talking about the Nazir. Remember that a Nazir, upon completing the period of being a Nazir, has to bring karbonot, spring offerings. And one of the karbonot he brings is me'asher chata al hanefesh, because he committed a chait against the nefesh. So there's some debate as to what exactly that line means. What does it mean? He committed a chait against the nefesh. You've heard this discussion before. The discussion is usually raised the other way. It's talking about what the question of what a nazir has done wrong as a nazir. Whether the nazir completed the process correctly or didn't complete the process correctly but became impure. What is the nazir's sin? Because the text sounds like, and this is what the Talmud picks up on, it sounds like we're saying the Nazir has sinned by being a Nazir. And so one view in the Gemara, this is Bar Kapara's view, is that the Nazir has sinned by abstaining from wine. Meaning, when Hashem tells you something is permissible, it's not for you to say, I'm going to abstain from it anyway. That there's something wrong with this level of asceticism. That's the view of Bar Kapara. And according to that, when the text says that the Nazir has to bring this korban, this offering, because chata al hanefesh, he committed a chait against his nefesh, it means he has harmed himself by refraining from wine. But that's not everyone's view. Yeah.
Do we hold by that nowadays?
That what? That you shouldn't refrain from things that are permitted?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, yes, unless there's a justification. Meaning the Nazir, in the end, if the Torah really believed that he shouldn't do it, mm-hmm. then you wouldn't have this as an option.
No, but
the Torah wouldn't have created it as an option.
So the opposite. You're supposed to do something and you don't. I'm thinking about drinking wine on Purim.
Different issue. Hold on.
There's some things that you just don't want to do.
Correct. Well, if something is a mitzvah, then whether I want to do it or not, it's my mitzvah. I don't like taking the tennis ball and bringing it back to my neighbor, but nonetheless, what I have to do. I have somebody who's an enemy of mine, and he's caused me no end of trouble, and I see that his animal is stuck by the side of the road, and he's having trouble loading it. I am responsible to go help him load it and get over it. You know, there are all sorts of times I'm told, get over it about, you know, in the name of doing what the Torah wants me to do.
Does it go as far as...
I am not... One second. I want to make sure to focus on this for a minute.
Okay.
I am not talking now about drinking on Purim because that's a completely separate halachic discussion. For anyone who wants my view on that, you saw my weekly email that I sent out a couple of weeks ago, and you know my stance. For those who didn't see it, well, email me later. I'll send you the link. But that's not the point here. The point here is that this is something which he refrains from, which he doesn't need to refrain from. In the event that there's a reason for someone to refrain, there's addiction concern, for example, or he knows what he's like when he drinks, that's a completely different story. Then it's appropriate for him to refrain. What Bar Kappara is saying is that as a general rule, if God permits you some kind of pleasure, it's wrong to say, I'm going to stay away from it. And that's Bar Kappara's philosophy. On the other hand, the Rabbanan, the sages, speaking against Bar Kappara's view in the Gemara there, disagree. And they say that's not at all true. They say that's not what this means when it says chet. When the karban is called a chatat, when the karban that he brings is called what we usually translate a sin offering, it doesn't actually mean an offering for sin. What it means is it's a type of karban which, it's true, is often brought for sin, but not exclusively so, because we know that the karban called chatat is brought in a variety of circumstances, not all of which have anything at all to do with an aveira, not all of which have to do with a transgression. So here there is no sin. So what Tosfot now has to deal with, there's a lot of backdrop for something that's really just a grammatical note, but what Tosfot is bothered by is, if you take the view that the Nazir has done something wrong, then I understand when the Torah says he has to make up for Asher Chata al Hanefesh. Chata al Hanefesh, he sinned by abstaining from wine. But if you take the view of the sages that there was no transgression in being a Nazir, then what does it mean when the Torah says Chata al Hanefesh? So their answer is, to quote our sentence here, it's an expression of deficiency. Chata here does not mean sin, but it means deficiency. Something was lacking. And he gives you a couple of examples to that effect. However, he specifically rejects, and this is why I wanted to see this, he specifically rejects the idea that that's what chet means when we talk about someone having sinned. In other words, the Tosfot is of the belief that the word chet actually has multiple meanings. Sometimes it means lacking, missing, like in our discussion here, like the review of the sages of the Nazir. And sometimes chet actually means transgression. You've done something wrong. And in his view, it's a mistaken liberalization to say that a chet that is a transgression is a chet that is just lacking. That's the idea.
Is that where this sin of omission comes from, or not really?
I wouldn't say so. No,
okay.
I wouldn't say so. But yeah.
Well,
what do you mean?
I wanted to comment. Well, okay. Yeah. So I understand that one. I was going to comment earlier that being, let's say, a monk and living a solitary life and not, if one can, marry, have children, that would be extremist
So
being an ascetic, which goes against halacha, would be. I'm relating it to that.
Yes, that's exactly where Bar Kappara is usually quoted.
Right.
Bar Kappara is usually quoted for the sake of making that argument that Judaism is not a monastic religion.
Mm.
And you will not be surprised to know there are views on both sides. But that's certainly the dominant view, is that that's what Bar Kappara is weighing in against, and that Judaism in general is not a fan. You know, we talk about the idea of kiddush, and you take the wine and use it for a mitzvah, you sanctify it rather than say, I'm going to stay away from it.
Mm.
But once again, your mileage may vary on that.
But throughout the Bible, for example, they told Hannah not to drink because she was going to have Shmuel.
Hannah did that herself. Hannah said he's going to be a Nazir. No, you're thinking of the mother of Shimshon.
Both, I was about to say.
Okay. So only the mother of Shimshon. The mother of Shmuel makes that decision herself that Shmuel is going to be a Nazir. Hmm. The mother of Shimshon is told to,
yeah.
And as we discussed, you know, you was before you joined the Shir, but when we read that story, so some view that as Shimshon is known to be trouble. There are certain traits that he has. You won't like him when he drinks, therefore let's keep him away from drink.
No, but she was supposed to be away from drink, well,
that,
too.
Right, but it's part of the preparation such that you will know he has to stay away from these things. It wasn't about her, per se.
What about in her womb? I mean, there's, you know, she's not drinking, and then...
Then he's not drinking either.
...preparing him for...
Right. Yeah.
You know,
correct. Correct. But it's a distancing of her for the sake of him.
Okay, right. I understand.
Okay. Sorry?
Well, I'm asking what the...
No, it's something else. Okay. So, so Binyamin rallies for war, and then on the other side, everybody else is ready for war. Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17, V'ish Yisrael hispakdu levad mi Binyamin arba me'os elef ish sholev charev. Everybody else? 400,000 swordsmen. Kol zeh ish milchama, all of them were warriors. Yes. Now,
do you think they all came up this time, like, you know, other times they didn't, this time, like, what was it? Why was this
the rally?
Because it was an abomination.
Because it was just so terrible.
It was so
this
terrible?
Is so above and beyond.
Like,
yeah.
This never happened to anyone else. Or like kind of society where they weren't living in a very lawful society, most of them anyway. Yeah, don't you think that there was lots of these gangs and rapes? And
I would hope not.
And, maybe they know. But it sounds like there was so much lawlessness around.
Brutality.
Everywhere.
It sounds to me like their feeling was, no, this is really above and beyond. You see it in the way they rallied. The thing that is of particular interest, though, which may explain it, is the fact that they know they're going to win. Mm-hmm. It doesn't dawn on anybody that this little town of Gibeah, even if they're defended by Binyamin, is going to do anything meaningful against the rest of the tribes of Israel. You know, as opposed to Devorah's war against Canaan has been enslaving us for 20 years. Or Gideon's war against Midian. Midian's been over us for 7 years. So there's a fear of, maybe we should just leave things as they are and we'll just pay our tribute. Here...
It's like an easy win.
It's easy.
Yeah.
It's like... and also, if there has been a lot of this going on, then maybe this is what broke the camel's back. Maybe once and for all, we're going to show the rest of the country this is not acceptable.
Right. Now, you had 400,000 before. We already mentioned the 400,000. But there it was when they were an assembly to pursue justice. Meaning, now we're going to go to them and we're going to get everything done. But now it's a military force, and that's the repeat of the 400,000. If you take a look on your sheet, I showed you from Malbim in number 6. He says, V'hayam misfaram gam ata arba meos. I added in the word Aleph. It was now also 400,000. Modia shakimu divrayim velosar echad mehem lebeiso. The point is that they stuck to their word. Nobody left. When they thought they were just, you know, in a legal capacity and there's no bloodshed, so they were 400,000, I might have thought at this point someone might leave. Veloshavu kol yarei v'rachaleva, the domain, the people who are afraid and the like, they didn't leave. Kelchu kulam, all of them persisted in this battle.
How big was the nation all this time?
Well, if you have 400,000 men of military age, right? That's your basic group. Plus, I don't assume that means that that's all of the men throughout the land.
There are older people. There are young.
No, but even just men of military age. I don't think you necessarily brought in all of them because I don't imagine that all the farms and everything else just dropped all their. Yeah, I.
Is it like half?
It's very.
Most?
I don't know. No idea. So they rally for war, and here goes with the war. Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. Vayakumu vayaalu beis el. They arose and they ascended Beit El. Vayishalu Belokim, and they inquired of God. Vayomru Bnei Yisrael, they said, Mi yala lanu batchila la milchama em Bnei Binyamin. Who should go up for us first for war with Binyamin? Who should go first? They asked God. Asking God means that you approach the Urim Batumim. You approach the Kohen Gadol. The breastplate of the Kohen Gadol has the gems on it representing the tribes. And the Kohen Gadol receives some kind of prophecy via that and gives you your answer to your questions. I gave you on the sheet, if you take a look at number 8. We're not looking up those psukim now, but I just wanted to show you that in the book of Shmuel, this is a constant. This idea that when you're going to go to war, you inquire of God, what should I do? How should I do? Will I win? Those types of questions are standard in the book of Shmuel as what you do when you when you're going to go to war. So they inquire who should go first. Vayomer Hashem, and God said, Yehuda batechila. Yehuda should go first. I forgot that we had not done this yet. I thought we had done it already. That's the problem when you prepare too far in advance. I already have a few questions, though, just on the sentences we just read. Psukim Yudchet, Yudchet, sentence... Actually, no, it's just Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. What's wrong in this sentence?
Yeah. Well, why are they in Beit El? They should be in Mishkan HaShiloh.
Mishkan is in Shiloh. And where were they before? The Jews themselves?
They were in
Gilgal.
Mitzpah.
Right? Remember we said they gathered at Mitzpah. That was the place of Yehoshua's victories, and it's a special place, and we said Hashem is with them in Mitzpah. So why are you going to Beit El when you were in Mitzpah? That's one question. And then the other question you have to ask is Ricky's question, which is, why Yehuda? Why is Yehuda picked to go first?
Why wouldn't they do a unified? Like, couldn't it be like representatives from each tribe?
That could have been the answer. God gave them this answer.
Or they could have asked, should we even go to war?
Right. They don't even ask, should we go? They ask, who should go?
They're very confused.
So why Yehuda? God said Yehuda, so it's Yehuda. Why is there a question?
Well, the question then is, why Yehuda?
What God
you
said.
Ask. Mm-hmm. But why did God say?
But I heard why have we seen them go ask God?
So again, it's going to be a popular thing in Shmuel. They haven't fought wars in Shoftim other than with people God sent them. There's one reference where they do ask God, and we're going to come back to that. But other than that, if you think of it, Devorah has a message from God saying, go to war. Gideon has a malach come to him and say,
and
go to war.
And that's just general everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have a force like this.
Right.
It's whoever you can get your hands on.
But you say that this is before the Shoftim.
Correct. Right. Correct. And it's part of the era of the Shoftim. It's after Yehoshua and before...
So it's before Dvorah and before...
Correct.
Gidon.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So, first, in terms of Beit El, what exactly are they doing in Beit El? So Radak offers you a couple of answers for this. You take a look on your sheet at source number 7. He says, has his first answer, Hanir Abeinai. It appears to me, Ki al Shiloh Amar, Kisham Hayaha Aron. It's actually talking about Shiloh. Beit El just means house of God. It doesn't have to mean the place was named Beit El. It's Shiloh. They went to the Mishkan because they want God. Even though we said God is with them in Mitzvah, nonetheless, they want to go to the place where the nation goes to serve God. Then he offers a second idea. He says, V'itachen lefaresh, you could say gamken, sheviu ha'aron lebeit el, ki beit el samuch l'shiloh hu. It could be they actually brought the aron to Beit El. We do have a place named Beit El. It's not far from Shiloh. So it could be that they actually brought the ark there. Ve'viu sham l'ispalel sham, they brought it there to pray there. V'yaneim ha'kel yis'alev bizchus Yaakov shebirei choso alokim sham. Why there? Because that was the place where Hashem blessed Yaakov in Beit El. And by the way, the Nolad Bo Soperek Binyamin. That's where Binyamin was born. So we are going to pray to God on the site where Binyamin, our current enemy, was born. However, Radak notes this is exceedingly unlikely. First of all, the pasuk doesn't sound like they brought the aron there. It sounds like they went to this place where the aron already was. The pasuk says that's where the aron was. But more to the point, Ralbach notes, it's unlikely because you know whose tribe Beit El is in? Whose land is Beit El built on? Binyamin. That's not where you're going to go to rally your forces if you're fighting against Binyamin. You don't go into the enemy camp in order to do this.
So where's Shiloh? Is that also in
there? So Shiloh is not in is not in Binyamin. Shiloh is it Ephraim or Manasseh? It's in Yosef's. Shiloh is in Yosef's territory. I just don't remember if it's Ephraim or Manasseh.
It looks more Ephraimish.
Ephraim? Okay.
Well, it looks on this map Ephraim, but I don't know how accurate.
Got it. Okay.
But didn't they used to take the ark with them to fight, like for protection kind of thing?
So that's a good question.
They did at one point with the
team, and that was a mistake, though. That was a mistake. We're going to have to discuss this more when we get to that story in Shmuel and find out, you know, that they take the Aron to war, what exactly the protocol was. But it seems like this was not what they were doing. Even though we talk about this, the Aron leading them and so on, it was not part of the, it was not supposed to be part of what they would do when they went to war. So they go to Beit El, which either is they went to Shiloh, or they brought the Aron to Beit El, and that's where they were, but that's unlikely. And they inquire of God. The inquiring of God, if you take a look at source number 9, this is the Gemara's description of what this looked like. Lama nikra sheman Urim v'tumim. The breastplate of the Kohen Gadol with these gems on it is called Urim v'tumim. So what does that mean? Urim, like or, shemi'irin es divrehen, they illuminate their words. Tumim means shemashlimin es divrehen, they make their words whole, meaning they fulfill them. Meaning when something is stated by the Urim v'tumim, it is going to come true. Kol Kohen, and then the rest of the line is very important, as we'll see. Kol Kohen she'eno medaber beruach hakodesh u'shchina shora alav ein shoal in bo. If the Kohen does not have divine inspiration, if Hashem is not manifest upon him, then you don't ask him questions for the Urim V'tumim. It isn't the magic breastplate that just has answers. You need that connection to God. Shari Sha'al Tzadok V'al Solo Evyasar V'lo'al Solo, because we'll see later on in Navi, Tzadok HaKohen asks questions and it works. Evyasar asks and it does not work. But here is the point that Alina made. Take a look at Malbim in number 10. V'lo sha'alu im ya'alu l'milchama. They didn't ask, should we go? V'lo im yatzlichu b'milchamtam. And they didn't ask, will we succeed? Ki batchu al gvurasam v'al zro'am zro'a basar. They trusted in their own strength. They trusted in their own arm. And figured, we're going to win. In other words, ish hayashar be'inav yaseh, right? Each one does that which they think is right. But here, we come back to Ricky's question. Yehuda. Why Yehuda? It's fascinating that it's Yehuda.
Well, because the story of Yehuda and Binyamin in the Torah, Yehuda was the one who said, no, keep me here. Don't keep Binyamin. I don't know if that has anything to do with that.
Right. So one level of irony here is that Yehuda is the one who takes responsibility for Binyamin. When Binyamin is going to be held captive by Yosef, because he was a thief, right? When Binyamin had stolen, I mean, obviously he didn't steal, but that's what they think, right? And originally, when Yosef asks them to bring down the youngest, right, Yehuda is the one who says, I will be responsible for him. You can demand him from me. Yehuda is the one who has to take care of Binyamin. And after this story, that's the way it will play out in history. Meaning Yehuda and Binyamin are the allies. After this terrible story, going forward, when you talk about the two tribes and the 10 tribes, the two tribes who remain from the south are Yehuda and Binyamin. They're allies. They're supposed to be close. But what has happened here is the opposite. What has happened here is that that bond between them is split, and now Yehuda is specifically the one who is going to go to war against them. Sorry? That's how angry, but also it shows the depravity, what the depravity has led to because of this event. That's one irony. There's a second irony. Before on that?
But why are we discussing it if that's what God said?
Because we want to know why did God pick Yehuda.
Oh, we want to know what he thinks.
When we can figure it out.
If.
There are many times when we'll ask a question in a pasuk and end up saying, I don't know. However, there are times when there's something that we could actually deduce.
So we're trying to see God's thinking on this.
More or less. Or I wouldn't call it his thinking as much as his message.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
You know, and it's like Tamei HaMitzvot, right? When we try to figure out what we're supposed to learn from a mitzvah. For me to say, well, God made this mitzvah because X is quasi-heresy. For me to say, God gave us this mitzvah from which we can get this benefit, we can learn this lesson, we can develop this trait or whatever, that's fine. I'm good with that. So that's the, but that's one irony. There's a double irony here, though. Go back to the beginning of Shoftim, chapter 1, sentence 2. As far back as you can go. When they after Yoshua died, the Jews inquire of Hashem, saying, "Who is going to fight the Kanani first?" And Hashem said, "Yehuda Yale, Yehuda shall be your leader." And at the time when we learned that, way, way back, it was, you know, 60-something weeks ago in terms of our classes. But we said at that point that the reason why it's Yehuda is because Yehuda is a leader, right? Yehuda personally was a leader, and the tribe is identified as a leadership tribe. But now, the enemy is no longer Canaan. The enemy is us, right? To quote Pogo. They see the enemy, and he is us. And it's meant to highlight that we have made peace with the people we were supposed to fight, and we're fighting with those with whom we should have been at peace.
Because there's no king.
All because there's no king. The lack of a king is so catastrophic. And yes, this is building towards what we're going to see in Sefer Shmuel. Fine, have a king, because it ain't working without one, basically. Even though, in other parts of the book, we have anti-king polemics. Like in the story of Gideon and Abimelech, you have anti-king elements. You know, Abimelech wants to be king, and he's a disaster. And Yotam tells his parable about the grape and the olive and the date and the fig, and they're all asked to be king, and they all refuse. It's an anti-king story at that point. But here, this is just... like, well, if you don't have a king, you're in serious trouble. You need it.
Maybe democracy.
Yeah, democracy. That would be nice, because Abimelech would have done well. Yeah.
But before the king, there were all the shoftim.
Before the... well, that's this period.
You're saying that this is before all the other shoftim.
This is right before the rest of the shoftim. The shoftim will run from this story all the way through Shmuel. Shmuel is the last of the shoftim.
Rather than a king.
So, bless you. Bless the,
so in 19 king, there was no shoftim either?
Sorry? No, there are.
Shoftim.
Right.
There are shoftim?
I don't understand. They were shoftim. From Perek Gimel, from Perek Gimel all the way through Perek, was it Tedvav? From Perek Gimel all the way through Perek, maybe Ted Zion, we had shoftim. Right? It was, Perek Gimel through Perek Ted Zion. Chapter 3 through chapter 16, we had shoftim. That's correct. The shofet is a step towards a melech, but isn't a melech. In other words, look at the tapestry of the book. You start out with Yehoshua, right? Yehoshua, in his day, the people obey. The people listen. He has no issues. He dies, and then there are a few people from his generation who outlive him, who are leaders as well, such as Elazar the Kohen Gadol. And then, when they die, there is this interregnum. You have this period in between where there isn't a king, there isn't a leader. Terrible things happen. Hashem appoints Otniel ben Kenaz as the first of the Shoftim. And then a whole series of Shoftim whose job is to try to lead the Jews. They do not have the powers of a king. They do not pass the leadership to their children. They do not have all the wealth. They, it seems like they don't have the federal authority. They seem to be more local, although that's unclear. That's some debate. But they don't succeed in doing the job. And finally, the Jews come to Shmuel, the last of the Shoftim, and they say, we want a melech. And some of them want a king for good reason, because of this. And some of them want a king because everybody has kings, and it'll make us a stronger military power. And it's glorious for us to have a king, and that's sort of the problem. We have to get to that in Sefer Shmuel. But that's what's going on here, is you have this fundamental need to have someone who's going to take the nation in the right direction. That's what we're seeing. So let's see what happens. Psukim Yud Tet Chaf, sentences 19 and 20. Vayetze Ish Yisrael, I'm sorry, Vayakumu Bnei Yisrael Baboker. The Jews got up in the morning. Odd, it doesn't say Vayashkimu. Usually they get up early, not this time. Okay. Vayachanu Al HaGivah. I don't know if that reflects their confidence. Maybe it's because they said, yeah, I mean, what are we worried about? So there isn't a great effort going into this. We'll worry about it. Vayachanu al Givah, and they camp against Givah. Notice they're not fighting Binyamin. They camp against Givah. They're not looking for a fight against everybody. Vayetze Ish Yisrael Amilchama and Binyamin. But then Binyamin is there, and so they go to war with Binyamin. Malbim has a little bit of a different read, but I'm sticking with this read. Vayarchu Itam Ish Yisrael Milchama El HaGivah. And so the Jews go to war with them towards Givah. Sorry, it is just Yehuda, but they're the representatives of Yisrael. Vayetzu b'nei Binyamin min ha-givah, vayashchisu b'Yisrael b'yom ahu shnayim ve'esrim elef ish arza. They succeed in wiping out 22,000 of this force from Yisrael. Now, I don't know how many people you had from Yehuda. Maybe it means that Yehuda's in the lead and others are behind them. You know, batchilah could mean that they are leading, but they're not the only ones.
It's just a story that
an hyperbole. I don't believe that they can get
without the honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, saying you had 5,000 and then you had about 40 each. Then sorry. It's a lot of the tribe.
Right. So I went looking to see whether I could find any meaning in the number 22,000. The only thing I have, and I don't think it's related, is that the original Levium, when in the beginning of the book of Bamidbar, the Levium are charged with working in the Mishkan, and the Bechorim, the firstborn, are redeemed for Levium. So at that point, there are 22,000 22,000 Levim who are redeemed, and then there's some surplus, but don't worry about that right now.
Do we have any idea how big Yehuda was?
We do not have a clear number here at all. We could go back. The truth is, we have censuses in the wilderness, in the Midbar.
In the Midbar, but then
but there's been at least 30 years.
Can you slaughter so many people in one day?
Well,
without guns,
slingshots.
Left hand.
Oh, the slingshots. Do we take time to reload?
Could you not read it in a different way, that there is Elef and the Slingshot?
No, not so much.
In the numbers.
Sorry. So they get really smashed here. They get smashed. Now, that doesn't mean Binyamin didn't suffer casualties. Binyamin suffers casualties as well. Radak makes this point in source number 11. He says, "E'efshar shalomesu b'malchamos ha'im in Binyamin." It's not possible that Binyamin didn't have casualties as well in those wars, meaning the first stages. V'akasuv lomana elameisim b'hina gave Binyamin lifnei Yisrael. But the text only counted those who died when Binyamin was struck before Israel, meaning in the end, when the other tribes beat Binyamin, then we're going to find out the death toll for Binyamin. Right now, the focus is what Binyamin succeeded in doing to everybody else.
Did it in one day, or did it
we don't know if it's a day. It sounds like a day, the truth is, but I love Davka, not necessarily. So what happens? Keep on reading. Vayishazek ha'am ish Yisrael. Well, Yisrael is not done. They strengthen themselves. Vayosifu laroch milchama b'makom asher chusham b'yam arishon. What do Jews do? If something doesn't work, we do it again. So they say, we are going to set up another battle, same place. But first, Vayalu v'nei Yisrael vayivku lifnei Hashem. They went and cried before God, ado erev, until evening. That's what makes it sound like this is a one-day deal. Vayishalu v'Hashem lemor, and they asked of God, saying, Ha'osif l'geshes l'milchama im b'nei Binyamin achi. Shall I continue to go to war against my brother Binyamin?
Now he's the brother.
Mm-hmm. Now he's the brother. Vayomer Hashem alu elav, and God says, go for it. If you take a look at Abarbanel on your sheet, source number 12, he picks up on the brother reference. The Karu Achi called Binyamin my brother. Lahudia Shalohaya Belibam Imahem Eva Vesina Lamesim Bamilchama, to say, we still view them as brothers. They killed 22,000, and we're still going to view them as our brothers. We are not vengeful.
Why would they kill 22,000?
Sorry?
If they were still brothers, they would kill 22,000.
You know brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just say,
yeah.
The comment in here is the Israelites on that day, 20,000 and 2,000 men, which is
it's,
what.
No, it's have. Not. It's just because the Hebrew is Shnayim Ve'esrim Elef. That's the way the word. You can't get around
it. It's been bothering me.
I like that better.
Yeah, I mean, you can do what you like, but it's 22,000.
Okay.
Sorry. So Binyamin has succeeded in killing 22,000 of them. And then, Pasuk Chav Dalet, Sentence 24, quickly here. Vayikru b'nei Yisrael b'nei Binyamin b'yom ha'sheni. B'nei Yisrael goes to war on the second day. So it really sounds like it's one day and then another day.
Wow.
And also said b'yom ha'u before. Yep. Vayitzei Binyamin ha'giva b'yom ha'sheni v'yashchisu b'nei Yisrael od shmonas asar elef ish artza. They kill another 18,000. Kol eleshol fecharev, all of them bearers of swords. These weren't people who were unarmed. So now the death toll is 40,000. The only thing I know about 40,000 is that it's the number of Jews who attacked Jericho at the start of Yoshua when we first invaded. And I wonder about a little bit of a parallelism there. But I'm not really sure there's anything to gain by that analysis. But the bottom line is that twice we lose, and not in a small way either, to Binyamin. So what we're going to have to start with next time.
Hashem said to go the second time.
Yeah. God said, sure, go ahead.
Testing our faith in God. Question, but like, who should go? But the second question, should we continue the war?
Right.
Like, it wasn't that, you know.
So
that's
now you start to understand why Ramban is so sure that this war was wrong. He says God is leading them into this because what they did was wrong. But we have to talk more about this. That's going to be the opening next time. Is so why did God tell them to go if they're going to lose?
Do you think they could finish the book?
Originally, I did. Originally, I did.
When are we breaking the table?
So that's part of the question, right?